Let's see, where were we?
Well, we were just talking about the types of problems that you were that getting on top of. Line. Yeah,
and we talked also about the processes that were developed in the lab, in the section. I mean, in the materials and the
materials and processes. Yes, the toughest process was to convince the R&D engineer who was sent over for materials and process. Mm-hmm. That they had a problem, because his whole reaction was, whatever you're doing, it's wrong. Mm-hmm. And these guys just couldn't seem to give credit to the lowly process engineer who was a bachelor's level guy, usually in manufacturing, or master's at best, that he had a credible problem. It was then that they discovered in one place that there was one guy who was marking wafers with green paint and then another ones with red paint. And that was so horrible that that story circulated for a long time. Much longer than the time it took to clear up the problem. But that was the toughest problem, because they considered, the R&D engineer, the PhD mostly, considered the process problem to be below his level of competence. Now that's a continuous problem today. It just is. Why that is a philosophical thing that we can argue about for weeks, I suppose. But that's a tough one. And those were the kind of guys that Gordon wanted to see could be sent out and help solve the immediate low yield, all of a sudden problems. All of a sudden, hey, get out to the NPN planar line, we have to shut it down. Mm. Whoops, I mean, you have to shut it down. It's spewing out rejects. They're doing everything the same. Everything is the same as they ever did it, but now it's spewing out rejects. And how do you define that? Yeah. And it takes I don't know if it's a PhD versus non-PhD behavior, or certainly a chemist versus non-chemist. There's certainly a practical user of the knowledge versus a new user of the knowledge. All there are barricades all the way along the line, and that's something that Gordon and always felt that maybe I could do a better job than others could because of the experience. That was
right.
I was familiar with process development problems. It takes one to know one, you know. That goes. But to solve that means that you lose production, lose yield, lose money, and the manufacturing managers are on your neck all the time to say, "How can you let us get away with that? How can you fix it?" There was another aspect that Gordon's view of research and development had to pursue, and there's another little anecdote that goes with this that I want to introduce you guys to. In addition to the R&D work that you want during developing new processes like epitaxial deposition, there are all kinds of ways of doing epitaxial deposition. New equipment has to be developed, bigger equipment, larger wafers. Larger wafers were a pain in the buttsky. Every time we developed something on a smaller wafer, the next ones we had to put in were larger. The tubes were never big enough, you know, so it's a continuous press. Now that's production problems. On top of that, we had to do troubleshooting out in the field among the customers. You know, if it was a problem that came back via manufacturing, hey, manufacturing just got a big return of rejects, and we don't know what they are. Go find out. And I was sent to find out one time. It sounded big enough that I had guys tied up doing this, so I went out first. Not that I could recognize the problem, but I could at least get a feel for the scope of what commitment people would be involved. And it turned out that there were a bunch of rejects that had come back from IBM. They had failed in the field. Fairchild planar, the great Fairchild planar integrated circuits had failed in the field, in the computers.
Wow.
At some particular, not short-term length of time, out there a ways. And what are we going to do about it? So, Cello, you know, get yourself a ticket right away and go out to IBM and take a look.
Who sent you?
Gordon. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Go out and take a look. Hey, why me? I'm not, you know, I don't have any, this, send the product engineer who deals with those customers, the product development engineer. So, no, you go. And I said, well, look, I'll go, but what kind of a problem is it? Well, they have something to do with their shorts developing in the field on the devices. So I said, well, I'll take Elon Blesch with me. Elon Blesch was one of my, he was a metallurgist, one of the brightest guys I had, and he was very good at troubleshooting. And recognizing what we thought would be metallization problems, because when we received the sample back, I asked Elon to take a look at them, and it looked like they were all shorted out. Like somebody had put a blast of current through the computer, and it caught those devices. So we went to IBM, and IBM was a big customer at that time. We went to IBM and discussed the problem there. They gave us the rejects. They told us what they had done to examine them, and we took all that with us back to our laboratory and began to examine them. And a wonderful thing happened now that I look back. We discovered what is now known as electromigration failures, something that was not known at the time. And it's a chapter in here written by Blesch and Cello on electromigration. It was a peculiar problem and had not been seen before. And it's a, if you look at the strip of metal on the device under high magnification, it looks like it has burned out. There's a strip, there's a strip of metal, and somewhere along in the metal, there's a bare spot. And it looks like that's been zapped. It looks like a shorted wire or in a light bulb or something like that. Looks very much like the same thing. You can take a look at this.
Yeah, I was just writing down the title.
Oh, yeah, this is, this great tome has been out for some time. That was discovered, that phenomenon was, we didn't know what we were looking at the time. But we started to analyze the thing, and we found a very interesting phenomenon that what happens is when you have a high current, which is running down a short strip, which means high current density. The current, it's the current wind, if you will, the electron wind, carries the atoms from one side to the other side. Now, normally, you'd look at, and leaves a void, or in extreme cases, leaves a void and piles up whiskers somewhere else, or piles up metal somewhere else. Well, you look at that and you normally say, well, that's easy, it was zapped, except the current is opposite. The flow of the current, being aluminum ions, goes from the cathode to the anode, and not the other way around. And this is what Elon and I looked at when we first, we thought about it, and then we said, we better go look at this closely, because this is, you know, doesn't it isn't kosher. So we looked at it under the electron microscope, and we went so far as to create the migration of atoms under the field of the electron microscope, and watch those little buggers move. Actually, we made a movie of it. electron microscope movie of it. If I had it around, I'd be glad to show it to you. Maybe I'll get it, and I have it here buried here somewhere. And you can actually see the whiskers forming. You can see that the metal is leaving the cathode, and aluminum is a positive ion. It has no business leaving the cathode. It's got to stay there, but it doesn't care. It just goes, and it's because of the current wind. There's a problem like that in light bulbs. This was the find that we stumbled on looking at the literature. the filaments in light bulbs will frequently go out and leave mm-hmm. a lump and an open, mm-hmm. But they'll leave it where the direction of the current is just the opposite of the charge on the atom. Mm-hmm. So we played with this and we looked at it and then we showed it to Gordon and Gordon refused to believe it. And Elan was good. He's a good metallurgist. He knew the electron microscope work. So he put a strip, a test strip of aluminum metal of that size under the electron microscope. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we focused a movie camera on it. And we watched the silly atoms move.
That's amazing.
From one end in about a half an hour type of film. Huh. Increased the current, they move faster. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they all moved from the cathode to the anode. And we reported, this is the report, the first time at the reliability conference, on the lifetime of aluminum strips. And it was, nobody wanted to believe this. Because aluminum was sacred. Yeah. I don't know if this one has the pictures in it. I think this has. The aluminum was sacred. It didn't go anywhere. It mm-hmm. it stuck mm-hmm. where you put it. Mm-hmm. Now, sometimes it could be, if you overheated the thing, you could alloy aluminum. Would find holes in the oxide mm-hmm. and it would puncture through because it got molten and then it would squeeze
right,
through
okay,
and
you'd, okay.
like on devices.
Okay.
That you could find from time to time and it was a crazy problem that we saw lots of times in our work. Mm-hmm. But these devices had failed in the computers in the field.
Hmm.
Oh yeah, here's a picture of it.
So how do you solve such a problem?
with great pain.
Uh-huh.
The thing that has emerged from that uh-huh. is one very simple thing. There is a new design rule being used for the past 2 decades now
okay.
already.
Okay.
That the maximum current density
okay.
that you can use okay. on an aluminum device, aluminum okay. bearing device, and not risk electromigration failure.
Okay.
So that means it's a limitation.
Yeah.
Hmm.
And here's the picture of it. Here's a strip right down here.
Right.
This is the cathode.
Mm-hmm.
This is the anode.
Mm-hmm.
Notice the voids that are formed
mm-hmm.
when aluminum particles within the strip move out.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
All in that direction, and then they pile up in these little hillocks that you see. Sometimes they pile up so high that you can grow a whisker.
Oh my God!
Of aluminum right off the thing. Now we've chosen those pictures. When you saw the film. It would scare the hell out of you. The normal failure on devices that you see in aluminum are devices like this. Here's an emitter,
mm-hmm.
and here's a collector.
Mm-hmm.
And when you run high currents, you'll get the aluminum punching through.
Okay.
It melts,
okay.
punches through the silicon into the silicon, punches through the oxide silicon underneath. It's a short.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's a normal.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody had ever seen this before,
yeah.
the electromigration.
Mm-hmm.
And that on the books today... is a design parameter
okay.
on designing circuits
okay.
using aluminum. And everything uses aluminum.
Oh my gosh.
And that was, I'm very proud of that finding. The people weren't convinced. We gave that paper, they wanted to know, how the hell do you know that? You've dreamed it up. You're talking about something that isn't true. But we've never seen this kind of thing. And we prepared, Elan did a beautiful job of preparing test strips of different sizes. And he showed them all in a movie on the electron microscope, and you can see the little hills form bigger hills, and the bigger hills form voids, and so forth.
Mm-hmm. And did what finally convince people? The film or
the data,
their own experience?
This publication.
The publication.
The publication.
Okay.
They then their and on top of their experience, they had seen this.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me, but could not credit the fact that there was aluminum bumps. In the vicinity of the anode.
Mm-hmm.
And that's opposite polarity. It mm-hmm. doesn't have the right to be there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And aluminum doesn't change polarity when it's moved through a strip.
Mm-hmm.
So we immediately issued a design parameter and went out into the literature, into
okay.
all the design handbooks of all
okay.
the companies that
okay.
that thought about this, that beyond 1.8 times 10 to the fifth amperes per centimeter mm-hmm. squared,
mm-hmm.
and that means the size of the strip taken into
right.
consideration.
Mm-hmm.
Don't design circuits with any current above that.
Mm-hmm.
I see.
Now, a lot of work went on to try to stop it. For example, one of the earliest works was to investigate all the metals that you could. Are they all going to do this? And they do.
Really?
Very little exception. Gold is, especially, gold doesn't have any place to stick. Mm. Aluminum. There was another piece of evidence that gold doesn't stick. I could have used it earlier. We did find that if you included a little copper in the aluminum, it slowed down the electromigration rates. Mm. So we published a whole table of in the literature, this kind of literature, on electromigration rates under various conditions in aluminum. And it was all due to the IBM failures. Oh, they thought we were magicians when we came back with that.
Mm. How long did it take you?
About 6 months. Mm. 6 months, and most of that time was preparing EM samples, electron microscope samples, where you could tell a guy that, but he wouldn't believe the before and after. Mm. But when he watched it form, not only that, you reverse the current, you reverse the procedure, you fill up the holes.
Wow, that's something.
Oh, that was, you know, Elon, when they talked about it, Elon says, all right, you got a point. Watch this. All he did was switch electrodes on a little DC generator. Mm-hmm. And immediately, those whiskers began to pull back in, and the little hillocks began to disappear, and those voided areas began to fill up.
Oh my God!
So you can restore it enough to where it worked. Now, of course, on a device, it wouldn't be that easy to fix it, because by that time the device would be destroyed anyway,
right?
Due to current pockets and so forth. But that was a typical case, the kind of case for which the Materials and Processes Department gained a little bit of notoriety in its field. And it was the IBM guys thought we were magicians. Then we found it on field devices, and they were all ready to sue Fairchild for bad aluminum on devices. What do you mean sending us to crap like this that fails after our first few dozen hours, you know? always you're accused first, and then you have to. You're guilty before you're proven innocent. So the electromigration was one of my finest satisfactions about the work I did at Fairchild, was to find that. Together with Elon Blesch, he was a marvelous metallurgist, and he was in my group as a metallurgist, and. He just went to work on test strips, and we looked at the results every day, and had a wonderful time with it. That was part of the effort that had to go on in connection with the work. And it turns out that every metal exhibits electromigration to varying degrees. The only ones that are very slow are copper, but they can't use copper on devices because it poisons junctions.
Right.
So they started to play around with IBM, not IBM, but RCA started to play around with copper aluminum alloys. And if it wasn't alloyed properly, then the gold would separate. I mean, the copper would separate from the aluminum. The aluminum would migrate, then you still got four. Mother Nature has a way of finding those things.
Yeah. So since we're talking about processes, I was wondering whether your group was working on ion implantation.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. It was worked on in two places. Uh-huh. It was worked on in the device groups themselves.
Okay.
The device designers.
Okay.
Because we had to use the same equipment. We only had, I think we only, in R&D, we had only two ion implanters.
Okay.
So we had to work together with the device design groups on ion implantation and its effects.
Okay.
The ion implanters, the device designers, did more of that kind of work than we did. Okay. But we followed very closely with them. Okay. And that, in turn, was the work that, a lot of the work that Jim at Stanford got famous for. He was doing a lot of ion implantation.
Okay. So you'd be using the tables that he produced?
Yes, that he produced, right. Okay. We produced smaller tables in the beginning, than when he really went at it, he produced these. Long tables, these in depth.
So Fairchild was not one of the early firms to actually use
ion implantation. Not as strongly as others did. Others spent more time with it.
Okay.
Total production time with it.
Okay.
But we were one of the early ones
in research and development.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Of course, the difficulty with doing projects like that in research and development is, production always has a 2 or 3 times larger unit to produce devices in volume, and you're trying to solve a problem that may or may not be volume related. So you have a small ion implantation unit, and you have to make sure that you can correlate the two sets of results. So we would do it jointly. We would have them do the ion implantation. We would look at the results. But it was a function of the equipment in that case.
Was your group doing anything with chemical purity issue in this time period, or was somebody, what's the chemistry group?
Yes, we did. We had a chemist. We had an active chemist in the group, and he was, his full-time job was in looking at the looking at the purity of chemicals from a standpoint of using what we call the test MOS devices in order to decide whether it was a problem. That is, if you analyzed the material, you could find practically no evidence of contamination or whatever.
Okay.
However, we had a very practical test that we used, and that was the formation of a diode, a test diode, which would be a lead and an aluminum pad on the oxide, and a lead going away. Now, you would impose a bias on that on that segment, and if there were any, and then make an MOS measurement, a CV curve, capacitance voltage curve for MOS for turning on that capacitor. And if it was contaminated, then the capacitor would just drift all over the place. If it was clean, the capacitor would have a pure CV curve.
I see.
So you knew what was bad, but you didn't know why.
Okay.
Most of the time it was due to sodium contamination, which we at Fairchild found to be the worst, the worst or best contaminator of devices. So we did MOS evaluations of using test structures. But
that's interesting.
But the analytical work that went with that we did outside by on a contract basis because of the analytical equipment, but that really wasn't definitive enough, because you could have a device that you could have a liquid which apparently was okay, but until you tested it on an MOS device, would it drift or would it not drift? You know, you do a CV curve, capacitance versus voltage, and you get a certain curve. If you put impose a steady voltage and there's something moving in the oxide, that CV will move. It's not supposed to. It's clean. It just ain't supposed to. You could either have a kink at the top, step at the top, or a step at the bottom. And you know you've got a contaminated one, but it's an electrical measurement, not a...
So that's how you were almost screening chemicals to see if
exactly.
they could be used, and
exactly.
then...
You know who's an expert at this is Bruce Neal.
Really?
That's his métier. He is great at MOS tests on CV tests on chemicals. You, if you get to talk with him, you can even have to make a special point of asking him that. But the CV measurement is a much more sensitive one than chemical measurements, because
that's right.
you can be in, you can be in parts per billion on a chemistry basis if you can find the sample. But it may or may not, the contamination may be enough to cause a drift in a CV transistor.
And and if you found a sample that you were having a problem with, or that was affecting the MOS, the CV curve in that fashion, then you would send it out to an analytical lab?
We could. We would do that. And usually when we found that, the analytical lab could find nothing.
Right.
Because this is much more sensitive.
Okay. So you just ruled it out?
So we just ruled it out anyway.
Huh.
We just issued a information to a circular to the people using that, that don't use Monsanto acids for this kind of thing. It was just an arbitrary choice, not very pleasant, but it had to be done.
Right. Did you have something?
But that work of figuring out what went wrong in production is one of the most vital jobs you could ask an engineer or PhD to do, And it's the hardest job to get that guy to do it. He's a PhD and this kind of chicken shit stuff doesn't appeal to him. Or what he calls chicken shit stuff.
But Gordon Moore and you both agreed very strongly on the opposite view.
The opposite view, absolutely. And that's why guys like Elon Blesch were so valuable. Because they could come up, Elon came up with the fact that electrical wires in light bulbs suffer failure because of electromigration. I didn't know that, but he did. He was a metallurgist.
Right.
And he knew about the failure of these wires in light bulbs. And the only reason that he knew was that they occurred in the opposite flow of current. The stupid aluminum atoms were smarter than we thought they were.
Well, I was interested how the Fairchild R&D lab had changed by this period of 67. Just in all aspects. I guess it's 8 years after you joined the company then, and
Let's see, how did it change? First of all, the big change was Moore and Noyce left in 68.
Right.
So that put a kibosh. They were leaders, or certainly Gordon was a leader in this kind of effort. I continued to work with the Materials and Processes Group. The group got smaller because we needed the engineers. We needed the R&D guys to operate production lines satisfactorily. And we just assigned them there and transferred them out of R&D. Because we just needed those guys and that kind of experience. So the effort in that regard diminished. The total effort diminished.
Okay.
Of course, a lot of the problems were solved, so they weren't problems any longer. But it took a toll on the R&D materials and processes effort to work with that. We had an equally capable team on epitaxial problems having to do with the preparation of epitaxial materials in silicon. We had a guy there that later moved to with Gordon moved to Intel, Ross. God, I gave the eulogy at his death. Ross Tucker. Dr. Ross Tucker, also from the University of Illinois, same as I was. And he was an expert in epitaxial deposition. And he could look at the surface of a wafer, an epitaxially made wafer, etched with the proper etching to reveal the bumps and the uneven surfaces, and could detect just what those were due to.
Wow.
Poor deposition in the epitaxial reactors and so forth. Guys like that were valuable, but they were also valuable on the teams for making devices as well. So you had a choice of how you put these guys to work. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
In every field, there were, in every area where there were problems, there were guys like that that could work in production if they wanted to and solve the problems there.
Go ahead.
Yep, so maybe we could talk about the movie that you're involved in on integrated circuits.
Oh, you're changing the...
Yeah, it's a different topic.
Around the same.
Entirely different topic.
Yeah.
There was a movie that we wanted to, it was made earlier than some of the work I've just been talking about. It was not an R&D movie. Well, wait a minute. I guess it did occur during the R&D period. The we were still, Fairchild was still in the mode of trying to really get on board and push planar devices, planar integrated circuits. So the movie guys, if I can find these things while you're when you're gone, I'll show them to you. The planar, the marketing guys said, let's make a movie and show it sometime to the entire United States and tell them what is a planar integrated circuit. And that Fairchild makes them, and you should be buying those. So we took the time to make such a movie. And one of the, in order to give it a kind of a credibility, we took one of the professors of Stanford, Jim Angel. You may know Jim. Yeah, he's, I guess he's retired now. But Jim Angel, a very pleasant guy, and I went down to Hollywood, into the incestual bowels of Hollywood, and we made this movie to be shown for 1/2 hour in the morning at 8 o'clock on four or five different days on what is an integrated circuit. And we did this, and it was a resounding success. The business rolled in. They also wanted to buy the movie. But it was a movie made of the processes of making an integrated circuit. And I don't know how I got was the guy involved. Oh, that came about for another reason, and that was the stuff that I had done earlier, all the way back with Bob Noyce. At the Shockley Laboratories, even. I maybe mentioned this to you, but before I became a semiconductor scientist, I was a physical organic chemist.
Right.
So I made a movie. I insisted that we make a movie called Tempest in a Test Tube. Did I tell you about
that? Yeah, the television show.
That whole movie was a great success. And that led to yet another one made, which I made together with Bob Noyce. When Bob was at Fairchild, beginning at Fairchild. And the experience of those two, the publicity guy said, hey, we got just a guy to do that. And so we went on to make this third movie, which was paid for by Fairchild, which was the manufacture of a planar integrated circuit.
What was the film that you did? The second one that you did.
It was called This Week in Science. And it was a general film, an educational film for whoever wanted to watch, in which every week we picked a different topic of science and had somebody on board who could explain that. That was the time, for example, you remember the Lockheed fiasco, the Lockheed Electra was a...
No, I don't know. Yeah.
The Lockheed Electra... was a propeller craft, but it was a jet prop. And three of them crashed at different times because the jet engines pulled out of the wings. It's pulled out of the wings, and the Lockheed found out in the air tunnel, in the air testing tunnels here at Moffett Field, that the engine had picked up a vibration, a low frequency vibration, as a consequence of its design and rotation. It had picked it up and would vibrate enough after something like 500 hours or whatever, it would pull right out of the wing and the Electra would crash. And there were three Electra crashes like that. So that was one topic of This Week in Science. Another one was integrated circuits.
And that was, period did you do that?
Was in the period, in transition from Shockley to Fairchild. So it sort of came with the territory. We've got this ham here, let's put him to work type of thing, you know. And of course, he didn't have to twist my arm in order to do that. But the third one was the making of an integrated circuit. And that was strictly a a sales tool. And it worked out very well. We got a lot of response to that.
And the This Week in Science program, was that was on public television?
Yes.
And was that paid for by just the public television?
Yeah, it was paid for by the Ford Foundation.
Oh.
The same ones who had paid for the earlier film on Tempest in a Test Tube.
Right.
So we got them to fork up some money. But the last one was paid for by Fairchild.
And you hosted This Week in Science?
Yes.
Oh, neat.
And each week, a different scientist appeared in his field on the program.
And that lasted about a year?
Half year.
Half year. Do you have copies of all of these
programs? I'm going to try to get these. I haven't done much to try to find them. I particularly like to have you see the Fairchild integrated circuit.
Yeah, one, I'd very much
as
like
well
to
as
see
the electromigration under the under
that would be great.
Microscope. We didn't make that film in time to show it at this particular reliability conference, but it would have been very drastic, very dramatic.
Yeah,
there.
Absolutely.
I'll try to get those for you during the next period.
That would be great. When we talked about the, before we get into just the situation that led up to Noyce and Moore leaving, I guess Grove too, we talked about when last and Orny left. What effect, right around this same time period, 67, isn't that when Charles Spork left as well?
Yes,
to
yes, he was the first.
What effect did that have on Fairchild?
A very strong effect.
Mm-hmm. Can you describe
yes.
it?
Well, he was the first manufacturing manager.
Mm-hmm.
A very prominent one and a very effective one.
Mm-hmm.
And he left a large void
okay.
in manufacturing that we had to fill somehow.
Okay.
We did get somebody in there temporarily, but mm-hmm. never to the degree that Charlie Spork was.
Okay.
I took a little bit of time to do some of that myself, but I was too busy at that time in these other problems. We had to have a manufacturing manager anyway, so we went right out to try to get him.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to remember who the heck actually took Charlie Spork's place. There were a couple of guys. It was even split up, I believe, at one time in a PNP and an NPN kind of division, but it was never as effective as it was when Charlie had it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you haven't talked to Charlie, he'll certainly tell you about that.
Yeah. Well, I guess I just to like.
Wherever
did,
you.
Did you have any inkling that that Gordon Moore was going to leave, or that Robert Noyce were going to leave?
No, no inkling. I knew ahead of time that ahead of their leaving that they were going to leave because Noyce told me.
Huh.
I had just returned in 1968. I had just returned from selling from together with Nelson Watt and Nelson Stone, the finance
mm-hmm.
guy.
Mm-hmm.
I had just returned in 1968 from Europe, where I had participated in the negotiations for the sale of Fairchild
okay.
back to the partners in SGS.
Okay.
We sold
okay.
out our share.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
We sold out our share. I don't remember. I don't know how much we got for it. It was far less than what it was worth, I'm sure, because we wanted to get out of it.
Mm-hmm.
SGS had gone hog wild and setting up factories everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mentioned that before,
mm-hmm.
and it just wasn't viable, and we were only 40% partners, so we had no
mm-hmm.
say
mm-hmm.
in yes or no, so
okay.
we
mm-hmm.
sold our share.
Mm-hmm.
On the way out, Noyce called me and said, while you're leaving SGS, I'd like you to take an exploratory trip to see what you could find out in Russia about the possibility of technological arrangements
mm-hmm.
of the kind that you had in Italy.
Mm-hmm.
See if you can work out something with the Russians.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, hey, that's interesting. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And Noyce was that was the way he did things. He shows up in Mountain View, and I end up going to Italy. Now he's showing up, calling me from a hotel in Europe, saying, why don't you go to Russia?
Mm-hmm.
So I and this fellow, Aldarizio, whose picture I showed you here, that dark
mm-hmm.
fellow,
mm-hmm.
Took a prospective trip going to the various institutions in Russia.
Okay. To companies in Russia?
To companies in Russia. To
okay.
Actually, to companies under the guidance of the Ministry of Electronic Industry.
Okay.
And I said, Pop, we can't sell anything to them. There are embargoes here.
Mm-hmm.
He said, well, can't you figure out something that can come in under the embargo window? Or it isn't so terribly important to us, but might be to the Russians.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, all I can go is find out what they're interested in. Mm-hmm. And I did that. Mm-hmm. And I went to 4 cities, including 2 in the satellite countries, Riga and also in way northern Russia. Mm-hmm. Nizhny Novgorod, and I went to these 4 cities and mm-hmm. talked to the Russian scientists mm-hmm. of the Russian Ministry of Electronic Industry under mm-hmm. the mm-hmm. guidance of Minister Kolesnikov, the guy who was then in charge. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And my pitch consisted of, we know that our technology is embargoed in Russia, mm-hmm. but there seem to be places at which maybe some are not as important as others, like computer building technology is tough. Mm-hmm. But we have a feeling that if you were interested, we could sell you the technology to make linear integrated circuits, mm-hmm. Ordinary amplifiers, mm-hmm. and linear products.
Okay.
So that's available. We'd like to talk to you about that. Of course, the Russians were completely interested. They were interested in anything that mm-hmm. anybody could come and tell them mm-hmm. about, because they were so starved mm-hmm. for such information. Mm-hmm. Well, I convinced Aldarizio of SGS, as his one of his last acts, to go with me mm-hmm. so that we could do this. Mm-hmm. Well, there were some interesting little highlights. One of the interesting highlights is when we got to Russia, we were treated like kings. You know, we were met at the airlines with special buses and taken into special places mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. we probably couldn't have gotten in otherwise mm-hmm. if we hadn't previously been invited. Mm-hmm. The invitation had been issued to Noyce.
Okay.
And Noyce passed it along to me.
Okay.
He said, do you still remember some of your Russian? I said, a little bit. He said, good, now you can go. No difference between Russian and Ukrainian in that case. And we got there. There's some anecdotes involved, at least one I have to tell you about. When we got there, we were met by a group of 2 very highly placed technological people in semiconductor in the Ministry of Electronic Industry, 2 Russians, and the 3rd was the interpreter, mm-hmm. who, when we sat down, was an interpreter going from Italian into Russian, mm-hmm. or Russian back into Italian.
Okay.
So I said, oh, well, it happens. I can handle it. Mm-hmm. And Aldarizio was with me. He's an Italian. Mm-hmm. So he can handle whatever we have to put up with. So we started going in that discussion, and the interpreter was right there, as like sitting like mm-hmm. viewer, and the 3rd party was over there. Mm-hmm. And we started going round and round and talking about it. I don't know quite what happened, but I said, we have planar technology, and I let something out which was English. And one of the Russians answered in English. And I said, oh, you speak English. And at that time, I had been in Italian all this time.
Okay.
So at that point, I got into English. Uh-huh. And he said, oh, yes, I've been to New York, and I haven't been to California. If you'll invite me, I'll come. You know, this usual kind of shit. So we started talking back and forth in English. Uh-huh. The interpreter got irate. She couldn't handle English. Italian, Russian, Russian, Italian. She was assigned because we needed to know Italian. Mm-hmm. on that trip, mm-hmm. and we weren't working in Italian, and she was deathly afraid that she'd lose her job because she couldn't translate the stuff. And she explained in Russian, of course, like I understood this. She explained in Russian that she has to. How can she be assigned to somebody for Italian when they're speaking English? Mm-hmm. She said that's an insult. Can't do that. So I picked up on that in the Russian, mm-hmm. and. I told it to Aldarizio. I told him in English, but Aldarizio spoke English fluently too. And we decided what we would do so she shouldn't lose her job is we didn't want to slow the Russian down. So he spoke from Russian to English to me. He spoke from Russian to me.
Right.
I translated the Russian to Italian for the benefit of the interpreter. He said, oh, yeah, well, you know, she says, sì, lo capisco, non è difficile. You know, she just kept going on, and then she would repeat in Italian what the Russian had just told me. we sat there for about an hour going around in a reverse circle. But she did her job. She translated from Russian into Italian and Italian into Russian.
Oh, that's funny.
And it was such a bureaucratic kind of a snafu. You know, they looked at the visiting delegation and they saw Sello, Alderizio.
Yeah, absolutely.
So Italians again, coming from SGS. We got it. It was taking an Italian interpreter, and she was good. I mean, there's nothing she couldn't handle in the Italian to the Russian. But there it was. But she did not accompany us on that trip to the various institutes. We then got an English interpreter, which the Russians preferred because they knew English before they knew Italian.
Okay.
And so we went to the various institutes, which they had opened up very surprisingly. Some of them were, a couple of them were, we later learned, really had never seen an American semiconductor scientist before, and they were anxious to listen to us and what we had to say. One of them, as a matter of fact, anecdote number two, one of them listened to my presentation on, it wasn't a presentation, actually it was a series of questions based on his work on silicon oxidation. And I asked him some questions about it in Russian. And I said, I didn't understand quite, could you explain it to me again? And suddenly, this guy, after a couple of questions, bursts out and he says, "My dear Dr. Sello, I am familiar with your work with Sa and Tremir on the penetration of phosphorus, of oxygen in a phosphorus structure. And I'm very familiar with that work. In fact, you just did it a few years ago. And I am familiar with that, and I wish to tell you that there are some errors in it." He was taking my criticism, my questions, as a critique of his oxygen analysis work. So I said, "I'd be very pleased to know, to hear what you have to say." And he spent about 15 minutes pointing out to me in a copy of my paper, translated in Russian from the English, where the errors that he felt were there. I took a copy and I said, "Would you please sign it for me? I'd like to have that, and I'll see that my copies get fixed up." Oh, he was beaming all over the place. They were so paranoid about this kind of thing, about knowing what had to be done in all of this work, but they didn't have the equipment. They just didn't have the diffusion furnaces. They didn't have the deposition furnaces. Ion implantation wasn't there yet. They just were starving for information. Nothing ever came of it because they still had a terrible problem. Kolesnikov, who, by the way, then after that came to the United States to meet Noyce. I arranged for him to do that, and we got him a permit, and he came and visited Fairchild as a return visit. They really, understood the problems, and they wanted to be sure that this was equipment that they knew how to use, and would we support it and back it up? And of course, Bob Noyce said yes to everything. I mean, what else can you say? No, we're not going to do it. I mean, this is crazy. Why are you here? You say no, we're not going to do it.
Right.
And in fact, Dr. Sello will come and help train you in that. So I said, "Hey, thanks a lot, Bob. Yeah, glad you're telling me." Of course, they knew of our previous visit, so that was more or less dressing, you know, coverage on the project. But it never worked. They had a problem. The big problem was not just lack of information. The Ministry of Electronics Industry in Russia at the time, it's different than that now because it's more open and they don't have the same structure. But at that time, the Ministry of Electronic Industry was in charge of making the products that the Russians couldn't buy from the outside world.
Okay.
Now, if the Russians couldn't buy ordinary audio amplifiers made in silicon, they'd have to have the technology to make it, and we would sell it to them. That would have been easy, a piece of cake. But the same ministry that had to lay out the few million dollars worth to buy the equipment to run that also had to defend to their boss, "Why is it that you can't make these and you want to buy the equipment from the Americans?" So they had another cross to bear. We didn't know that at the time. I learned about it afterwards.
So there was an issue with the supplies that they would need to buy to do the work.
And they had to admit, they had to admit they didn't know how to, they didn't know the technology to make those products. That's why they had to have the Americans. And to admit at the high levels that in the presence of the Americans, they didn't know what the Americans were doing or didn't have any knowledge of that. How can they do that? Somebody's head would roll. They rolled for less than that.
Yeah, right.
So a very interesting little go-around that we had during that period. And it was, Noyce was very advanced in that regard. He went balls out, I should say, to get the Russians invited to the to Silicon Valley. We had to clear them through 16 different agencies down here on the peninsula.
I mean, it sounds... I don't know, but I it's very hard to imagine that that took place. I mean, were there any other semiconductor companies trying to do business there?
No. No, that's where our program, that still needs to be described a little bit more, our program of technology transfer to penetrate the marketplace had the edge.
Okay.
If we could... sell them the audio, how to make audio amplifiers, and then get 10% of their market, which they would gladly do because they want to sell them too. We'd have a good thing going. But in their, from their side, so ours it looked like a good venture, but from their side, you know, why are you buying this? Can't you make it? And you've got all this beautiful set of 15 semiconductor factories, you can't make a silly audio amplifier? How do you justify that, Mr. Kolesnikov?
Okay.
And Mr. Kolesnikov has to justify it. It was premature. And at that time, there was still enough Byzantine thinking in Congress that if you sold them a diffusion furnace that was going to make audio amplifiers, if somebody in Congress, some of the hard right, would come up and say, hey, they're going to make atom bombs with that thing. How do you know they're going to make audio amplifiers? Well, we know because we're going to be there and we're going to be checking on them. And you can't make atom bombs in the things that you make audio amplifiers. Oh, no, it's all high, the same high tech, you know. We there's a lot of that that we had to put up with during those years. Wrongly or rightly, I'm not taking a position. Now, if that were to be something that were for super fast integrated circuits, digital integrated circuits, we wouldn't have tried that because for that they need certain computers, they need certain equipments that they could turn to use on something else.
Right.
So you didn't want to get into that. But this was just an exploratory trip on, by invitation.
Sure.
To find that. But it made an interesting search.
And was it in the context of, maybe it's time for one more question, and it's just a simple one. Was it in the context of that working with Bob Noyce about the Russian or the Soviet possibilities that you intimated that you heard that he was going to be leaving? Or
It wasn't in that context, but it was 68, early 68, and I returned to give my report to Noyce. He, at the time, was in a hotel in New York, and I had to find out from his secretary where he was, so I said, well, I got to go through New York, so I'll just stop and give him a personal report. It was fun talking to Noyce anyway. I mean, what the heck? Why not?
Yeah.
So we had dinner, and it was over dinner that he told me that there was a likely possibility that he and Gordon would be leaving Fairchild. But that it was extremely secret, that I was not to say anything about it.
Okay.
The word had gotten around anyway. Okay. What he thought to me was extremely secret. I hadn't heard about it, but that didn't mean that it didn't get around. That they would be leaving to form another company, not to go to Intel, but to form another company.
Right.
So I kidded him about it, and I said, oh, gee, that's nice. Include me in, you know, that kind of stuff. Okay. Noyce was open. He had very few secrets. And, of course, too open to many people. But then when I got back to the shop, it rapidly developed that that Moore and Noyce were going, not Grove. Moore and Noyce. Grove was a later addition to that group.
Okay.
And Grove was a later addition because if he hadn't gone to Intel with those guys, Charlie Spork would have stolen him or tried to steal him for National. Okay.
Okay. Right.
So okay. he was a pricey character. Yeah, he was telling you about that.
Yeah, that.
They wanted him at National to direct their research.
Yeah,
which he could have done. I mean, hey, good man's a good man.
Well, maybe we should, just because of the time, I guess we need to stop here.